This podcast is not safe for work and will feature movie spoilers. It will feature scenes described of a graphic nature. It will contain language which most listeners may find offensive. Welcome to the podcast Under the Stairs. Hi everyone and welcome to the podcast Under the Stairs. This is episode 329. I'm your host Duncan McLeish. Welcome to the show. Up on this episode, we continue our run of shows this month, December, listener choice. This one is your dream double bill as voted on the Facebook group page. You guys selected your dream modern gothic double bill, picking Bram Stoker's Dracula from 1992 and Crimson Peak from 2015. Reviews of both movies coming up after the first break. Before we get to that, as always, let's catch up with where we are. A very busy week coming at you from Under the Stairs. And it all began on Monday when we continue our look at Dexter New Blood. That show is killing it right now, ladies and gents, and I love every little thing it's doing. Today is your episode dropping on Wednesday with your listener choice. Tomorrow, we have the second and penultimate in our Russian Roulette franchise retro, looking at the Children of the Corn franchise. We'll be covering movies 4 through 6 on that episode. And I'll be honest with you, some of my favourite reviews of the series thus far, right in that some bitch. Then, we're going to tiptoe into Saturday, where myself and Derek Bourgeois will sit down and get a little bit kaiju, I believe is what the kids say, when we tackle the next installment in the Gamera series as part of that Gamera Arrow Video box set. Finishing off on Sunday with disc number 50. Is it the final disc? Who knows? 88 films are not confirming or denying anything, but the final disc number 50 in the Slasher Classic series for now. That is you all caught up, and we are going to get into this because I have two movies to discuss, and we're going to be doing it a little bit different because you guys asked for dream double bill for modern gothic movies. So rather than just sit and say, well, this happens and this happens and then this character says this and then this character says that, we're actually going to talk about what makes some gothic horror movies, or should I actually say gothic romance movies, because to be honest, that's kind of what they are. We're going to get into it right away after a short break with promos for shows that I love and the trailer for our first ever double feature. Let's talk about Crimson Peak from 2015. When I return, I'll be discussing that movie right after this.
Hello, this is the Doom Show. Keep on keeping on and keep on trucking, America. We don't listen to our feedback because we don't get any.
The truth hurts.
I just alienated the two people that give us constant feedback. Sorry, guys.
That's gotta go.
That's gotta go in there.
So on the show, we talk about giallo movies and slasher movies and cult movies. Sometimes we even talk about Cameron Mitchell and his movies. I am Richard. Who are you?
I'm Brad, the guy that's not Richard, or Jeffrey, or Simon.
That's right, we have four people, and we always talk at once, except to each other.
Jeffrey lives up north, Simon lives across the world, Richard lives in Penis, Alabama.
Hello, This is the Doom Show is a proud member of the Legion Podcast Network. Check out the other shows on legionpodcast.com. You can check out more Hello, This is the Doom Show at hellodoomshow.podomatic.com or at doommoviethon.com.
Check for our Amazon exclusive Hello, This is the Doom Show cookbook.
Do you like hot dogs?
We got them.
Do you like mac and cheese?
We got it.
Do you like cheddar?
We have it.
Actually, we don't.
No cheddar.
Just Colby. Colby Jack.
Hello, this is the Doom Show. We never gave up on you because you never gave up on us.
Wow.
Ghosts are real. That much I know. I've seen them all my life.
Would you be mine? Edith, this is my sister.
I don't think she's the right choice.
You have to trust me.
Thomas, your bride is frozen.
I'll run you a hot bath.
Parts of the house that are unsafe.
What was that?
A house as old as this one becomes, in time, a living thing. Never go below this level. It starts holding on to things.
Has anyone died in this house? Specific deaths, violent deaths.
In your own best interest, proceed with caution, keeping them alive when they shouldn't be.
If you're here with me, give me a signal.
She knows everything.
Do we have to do this? Must we?
Yes. You have no idea what they do.
What do you want? I have to leave.
You have nowhere else to go. This is your home now.
And welcome back. So you've just heard the trailer for Crimson Peak. This movie came out way back in 2015. My God, I remember it well. I was there opening night, ladies and gents, right there. Could not wait to see this movie. It came out in October. It was being billed as the must-see horror movie of 2015. Like I said before, coming out October 16th, if memory serves, in the UK. And yeah, this is Guillermo del Toro. And we all know how much Duncan loves him. Some Guillermo del Toro. But also, this is Guillermo del Toro. And we're going to get into why anyone that went out to see this movie expecting a straight up flat fucking horror movie may have been, I don't know, slightly confused. The writers of this particular movie are Guillermo del Toro as well, and Matthew Robbins. The movie itself stars Mia Wasikowska, Jessica Chastain, Tom Hiddleston, Charlie Hunnam, Jim Beaver, Bern Gorman, Leslie Hope, Doug Jones, Jonathan Hyde, Bruce Gray, Emily Coates, Alex Stockwell, Bridget Robson, Gillian Ferrier, Tamara Hope, Kimberly Sue Murray, Sophia Wells, and Joanna Douglas. Synopsis for this one, as listed on the IMDb's, is: in the aftermath of a family tragedy, an aspiring author is torn between love for her childhood friend and the temptation of a mysterious outsider. Trying to escape the ghosts of her past, she is swept away to a house that breathes, bleeds, and remembers. So, can I just say, just take a second here to say how fucking on point you guys were with this double bill. Not only does the theme completely work, I mean completely work. You nailed the theme. Some of the themes weren't great this year suggested, but this one on fucking point. And then the second thing is you picked two movies that I think, and I've said it before, are maybe the best example of gothic horror cinema of, you know, the last, 30 years? I think that this is top tier. This is as good as it gets. Now, as a listener listening to this podcast, you will recall in my first segment, I said gothic romance, not gothic horror. And I've literally just said the word gothic horror, which makes me a fucking liar. How dare you spit in my face, podcast host. You tell me one thing, then you sweep the rug away from me with the other one. You fucking cunt. Yes, this is true. I mean, the horror is here in both these movies. It's just not the primary driving force. I mean, they both have horrific elements. One contains ghosts, the other contains vampires. So, I mean, they're within our realm, our sphere of interest. And certainly the gothic style of cinema lends itself, more than just a little bit, to a review on a horror podcast, per se. But the primary driving force for both movies is actually love, which feels kind of weird. I've always said that the biggest crime that was committed against this movie is not the trailer, which everyone said it made it look like a horror movie, and it wasn't. That's not the biggest crime. The biggest crime that any marketing company or studio could perpetrate on this movie is releasing it in October. Had this movie released in February, in or around Valentine's Day, and been pivoted as a gothic kind of romance, or, you know, a horror movie for Valentine's Day, this movie would have had a lot less resistance than actually did. The primary driving force here is desire, love, and the longing to be with someone that fits with you. The story itself, I mean, it's not quite cookie cutter, but it's something you've come across before. Interestingly enough, myself and the rather delectable Dave Parker were recently talking about Orgasmo from the old Lindsay Baker box set. And we were talking about those kind of late 60s jally and how they are essentially examples of like mysteries based around entrapment for wealth. You know, it's this idea of kind of almost like carpetbagging someone for their money. It's ultimately there to extort from one person to another under the guise of something else. And that's what Crimson Peak is at its core. It should surprise no one that, you know, when he came to talk about this movie, Del Toro mentioned as one of his primary influences the cinema of Italy of the time period where Bava was making his gothic horror masterpieces. And you only have to look at a movie like The Whip and the Body to see that whilst that is definitely a movie that is dealing with ghosts and, you know, the kind of gothic element, it's still at its same time a bit of a kinky love story on the screen. And it falls somewhere in there. Crimson Peak owes so much to, you know, like movies and subject matter, like you know, something like Wuthering Heights. Certainly, something like The Fall of the House of Usher, that kind of the kind of works of Poe, but particularly in the way that these are shot, kind of the Poe Corman era adaptations for sure. Also, on some level, owes a lot to that kind of rich technicolor tapestry that like the movies that Hammer would put out, you know, 60s into the 70s as well. Del Toro would say about this movie on more than one occasion that when it came to getting the colour balance right in this movie, he spent more time running colour corrections on what he'd shot than any other movie he made. And let that sink in. This is a guy that has built rich tapestries in movies like The Devil's Backbone, or lush, vivid fantasy worlds in movies like Hellboy 2, or even Pan's Labyrinth to boot. So, I mean, this is a guy basically telling you that this was important to him. And it's important to him because it's integral to the story. The colour scheme tells story, very much in the same way that Bava will use colours to tell story. They're not just, I think it's sometimes people don't understand, like Argento's use of colour is, you know, it's the same colours as Bava, but it's used for different mechanisms. Argento at times is a kind of hyper-stylized version of colour to be kind of unsettling, where Bava used it for purpose. It was to, in some respects, make his movies feel a lot more expensive than they actually were, and in other respects, were used to hide and accentuate the scenes of terror on the screen. Crimson Peak has that as well. Ultimately, what you're dealing with here is, you know, a brother and sister incestuous combo who have inherited a vast estate but no money to keep it going, and thus have decided to embark on an elaborate scheme that involves the very striking, very charming, and very sexy Tom Hiddleston being a bit of a Venus flytrap for women, luring them in from rich families, marrying them, while his insane sister, Lucille, played by Jessica Chastain, will eventually off them. And lo and behold, they take that money, but that money is only going to go so far before it runs out, and that, you know, is not going to help things. At the same time, you've got this kind of love triangle between the character of Mia Wasikowska, who is playing Edith in this movie, Hiddleston's Thomas Sharp, who is this, you know, very suave British gentleman, and Dr. Al McMichael. Any surprising role by Charlie Hunnam? I don't necessarily rate Charlie Hunnam as an actor, if I'm honest. I know some people are switching off and saying, but, you know, what about Sons of Anarchy? He's fine in Sons of Anarchy. I have no issue with that at all. But he's not the sort of actor that I'm like, period piece. this biker guy needs to be in a period piece. Never thought of that. He's actually really, really, really good in this. MVP to me is Jessica Chastain. I think this might be my favourite role that she's been in. She's an absolute powerhouse in this movie, playing someone charming, aloof, dark, and dangerous, which are all great classic qualities of, you know, murderers or villains or schemesters in gothic horror movies, and she's the very embodiment of that. Moving away from the characters, what this movie has that really makes it excel, and excel it does, ladies and gents, is the attention to detail. Let's be honest here, this is Del Toro flexing their muscles. He'd done a couple of movies for the studios, raking in a lot of money, so guess what? At this point, he gets to do what he wants to do. So that is make this big, huge budget movie, which will allow him to build a house entirely for the set. This whole set that you see is basically his, like, house that he builds. It was built on a studio, and it's fucking incredible. The set design looks lush and lived in. It has, you know, the textures of, like, every room you walk into, you can almost feel like you could run your finger over a surface, lift it up, and be, you know, be presented with dirt and unclean surfaces. Originally, the idea here was to really kind of flex into, like, the idea once again of a kind of Fall of House of Usher sort of premise, and that principally relies on making sure the set design works. Whether you like or loathe those Poe Corman era productions, and yes, they are made very, very cheap, very much like what Baba would do, is there was a degree of attention spent to making sure the decor looked all right, and when that looked okay, people acclimate very quickly to the surroundings in the movie, so that you get that as well. I think that works, like, incredible. As his main influences out with, so we're talked obviously a lot about the gothic side, but you need to nail the ghost element well. And when Del Toro was talking about that, movies like The Shining, the original The Haunting from 63 and The Innocence from 61 were at the forefront of how he wanted to have this portrayed on screen. Now, I remember a ton of people moaning about the ghosts in this movie and how it was just CGI, and they respected Del Toro a little less for going down that road. And there is a sheen of digital effects over them, but all the movements and the design themselves are real. Those are practical effects. You've got Doug Jones in this movie. You don't bring Doug Jones into your movie and have him, I don't know, against a green screen, all lit up with lasers and not in a costume. That doesn't work, and that's what this movie does as well. It looks fucking great. It's gnarly. The ghosts are memorable in this movie. I don't care what anyone says. Like, you remember the ghosts in this movie. Their design looks great. It's tangible. There's something kind of drippy and weird, and I kind of love that about it. I think it actually excels in those aspects where you see the original ghost of Wasikowska's mother, this kind of almost grim reaper, kind of lady in black, sort of like image, which is very, very, very jarring to look at. And then on the other side of that, you get a little bit of that kind of red, kind of clay earth style of ghosts in the other capacity, which also works really well. So we've talked about the idea of the Gothic influence. We've talked about the idea of the, you know, the ghosts themselves. The romance is at the core. Wasikowska plays a very naive character who, you know, as an author, has a romanticized view of the world, and it's what allows her to be so easily duped by Hiddleston. But at the same time, she is torn against what her heart wants and what's right. What's right is a relationship with Charlie Hunnam's character, but what her heart desires is adventure. So of course she's going to be attracted to Hiddleston. And the further you kind of waltz down, and waltz is the right word because there's a waltz scene in this, very apt, as you waltz down further into this plot here, and the more the mystery unfolds, I actually think the more she becomes captivated with that character, up to the tragic demise of said character by the end. Alongside this, and this is not the first time I'll be saying this, powerhouse, absolute powerhouse cinematography in this movie. It's fucking awesome. And you have Dan Lauston in the, you know, in the photography chair for this one, working beside Del Toro, who, I mean, this dude has credits for days, yo. Everything from action to horror to drama, he's done some incredible works and has in the past worked with one Guillermo del Toro. I believe their first collaboration is on Mimic, but you know, when he returned to do this, you know, work for him here on Crimson Peak, he would then obviously go on and be nominated for all the awards on The Shape of Water when that won Best Picture, and also has returned to work on Nightmare Alley, which comes out this month and looks fucking great. Cinematography looks incredible, so you have that as well. Then let's talk about, and once again, another thing we're going to come back to again and again, score on this movie is lush. It's classic, it's imposing, it's whimsical, it's gothic. And it's at the hands of Fernando Velázquez. This guy as well, tons of amazing credits, mostly known for working with another great Spanish director in Juan Antonio Bioa, who, you know, did The Orphanage and A Monster Calls. So, you know, he's done some work there. I think that works really well. But, you know, through projects that have ultimately had the Del Toro kind of loving in the background, whether it's something like Mama, which Del Toro helped finance, Julia's Eyes, which I believe at the time was kind of on the cover, it was like, you know, aided or produced or helped by Guillermo del Toro. The aforementioned Orphanage, which, you know, is Del Toro all over it as well. So, you know, he's worked with them a lot in the past, and it really, really, really works. Even that Marabone movie, which once again is a Bioia film, but I think that the score really fucking sells this movie. Really, really, really makes it work, and I think that's also to its credit. The kind of sad thing about Crimson Peak is, like I said before, it didn't really set the world on fire. I actually think if we look at commercial success, it's probably going to be counted as one of the least successful Del Toro movies in terms of budget to what it made back. But I would argue it's maybe his most beautiful movie. Pan's Labyrinth could be the only movie I can think of that might actually contend for that. I love the creature design in Pan's Labyrinth more, but I think the cinematography and, you know, the colours and the actual style of Crimson Peak is better. But ultimately, it was judged on the genre it was released in, which was horror. And to be honest, in 2015, there's a lot of people that don't understand Gothic romance. And maybe they never want to. And that's fine. And went in looking for a movie that was as scary as the trailer made it out to be. And it wasn't. It wasn't. I mean, there are some vicious scenes in this movie. All practical effects as well. Absolutely vicious death scenes in this movie. But it's still, you know, it's not like at the forefront a movie that's there or designed to terrify you. Crimson Peak, I think, is going to be one of these movies that even 10, 15, 20 years from now, people are going to come back and rediscover and maybe change their opinion on. I certainly, from 2015 up to 2021, now know a lot more people that now have seen the movie and liked it that didn't go and see it when it first came out or saw it the first time around and didn't enjoy it, that have slowly kind of moved round to the spectrum of really enjoying this movie. And that's important. I think it's a very, very important thing in addressing a movie like this, which isn't designed to be seen as one-dimensional. It's not. It's a Del Toro movie. It's never going to be one-dimensional. And I think when you open yourself up to that and don't go in expecting to see the scariest movie of the year, when you go in and see that, I think that's when the movie really starts to shine. I think Crimson Peak is damn near as close to a modern masterpiece as you're gonna see. Is that fucking good? In the genre and realm that exists on, few movies in the last 30 years are better. So yeah, I'd give this a 5 out of 5 if you didn't guess from my review. I think it's absolutely awesome. And if you haven't watched it for a while, please go back and check it out. You will only be rewarded when you do. I'm going to take my second break of this episode. You're going to hear the trailer for the second of this double billage. We are going to be discussing Bram Stoker's Dracula from 1992, a movie that, if you've listened to the summer series before, you know I unabashedly love. So you're spoiling me. This is a treat yourself episode, ladies and gents, and I'm going to be right back to discuss the movie right after this.
This is a test of the emergency podcasting system. Listen to the Psychosemantic Podcast. Politics, movies, and political movies. Find us on Facebook, iTunes, Stitcher, LegionPodcasts.com. The Psychosemantic Podcast.
Here occurred the frightening and shocking history of Prince Dracula and the woman he loved.
I have crossed oceans of time to find you.
Yeah. Dracul.
There's a sinister, darker side to him. I find irresistible. I have never met any man with such a passion for life. He is unlike any man.
What are you?
Vampires do exist. This one we fight, this one we face. Can take on many forms. He is both young and old. He can appear as mist, as vapor, as the fog. And he can vanish at will.
Oh, my love.
The power of his evil desire has no end.
You've got to go to him. And you've got to love him.
She is a willing recruit and devoted disciple. She is the devil's concubine. Dagger!
Join me in eternal life.
Your salvation is his destruction.
I want to be what you are. I want to see what you see. I want to love what you love.
Take me away from all this death.
Make no mistake, he must be stopped.
And welcome back, ladies and gents. You just heard the trailer for Bram Stoker's Dracula from 1992. I did not see this one in the cinema, but I do remember getting a ripped copy of this on VHS and wearing that motherfucker out. This one is directed by Oscar-winning director Francis Ford Coppola. So two directors here that are walking in here with big swinging Oscar dicks. It's based, obviously, on the novel Dracula by Bram Stoker, but the adaptation here for the screenplay is done by James V. Hart. The movie itself, great cast here, and some dubious things we're going to get to. We have Gary Oldman, Winona Ryder, Anthony Hopkins, Keanu Reeves, Richard E. Grant, Cary Elwes, Billy Campbell, Sadie Frost, Tom Waits. What's he building in there? We have Sadie Frost, Monica Bellucci, Michaela Berko, Flora Kendrick, Jay Robinson, and some other folks that we won't bother spending much time talking about. Synopsis for this one is, if you don't already know, the centuries-old vampire Count Dracula comes to England to seduce his barrister Jonathan Harker's fiancée Mina Murray and inflict havoc in the foreign land. Can I just say, up front here, Bram Stoker's Dracula might be the last great horror movie. Now, let me finish this sentence before you throw your fucking device across the room. The last great horror movie that really encapsulates, maybe about five, six decades worth of horror filming techniques in cinema. Now, you're probably saying to yourself, Duncan, what the fuck are you on about? And that's a fair assessment. This movie utilises a bit of German expressionism, a la something like Nosferatu, but most specifically Dreyer's Vampyr, specifically in the way things like the actual shadows move, which are more in line with that movie than they would be necessarily with Nosferatu. It uses the kind of horror qualities of the Universal style, as well as the Hammer style, kind of covering the 30s, 40s and 50s. It then leans into some of the kind of miniature techniques and superimposition techniques of the 50s, 60s, and then captures the eroticism of the 70s, whilst bringing in a little bit of, wait for it, he's going to say it again, Mario Bava and the European style of the 60s, 70s and 80s, delivering a movie that lands in 1992. It's so bizarre that Ford Coppola only ever really did one gothic horror movie. He did technically do more than one horror movie, but I would not rush out to watch anything else he did in that kind of vein. So he covers it all, and if you appreciate the craft of cinema, Bram Stoker's Dracula is an opportunity to just sit there and be wowed by every little bit of technique that he's doing. If you ever get a chance, watch the making of feature for this movie and just be prepared to sit there and have your little mind melted. It's fucking incredible. But the I would say his biggest credit here is taking it away from the standard nuts and bolts, meats and potatoes Dracula adaptation that we're fully aware of, and actually making this a kind of love story at its core. This is a big old love story, big old gothic love story, and it works best for it. This to me is how I felt the first time as a kid I watched Frankenstein's Monster Die at the end of the Universal classic Frankenstein at the age of 5 and howled in my living room that they killed the monster. This is the same here. When Dracula dies at the end, he's an immensely sympathetic character. Once again, you may be looking at your device going, what? Watch the movie again. Dracula is weirdly sympathetic in this movie. Let's talk about the thing that everyone wants me to talk about and get out of the way first. Casting. This movie makes some of the best casting choices in cinema history, and also some of the most head-scratching, baffling choices in cinema history. Let's talk about some of the bad. Obviously, the movie had to be financed with a lot of Hollywood money at a time where Coppola's... credit in Hollywood was at a bit of an all-time low. It was coming off a couple of flops, and I believe, as rumour has it online, certainly, some of the factoids about this movie, is Winona Ryder actually was the one that approached Coppola with the script for this and say, you should make this movie. And the reason behind that is she was supposed to be in The Godfather 3, and I can't remember why she wasn't in it. I think scheduling, potentially. And the less we talk about that replacement, the better. But they still wanted to work together, and this was her pitch. So she kind of had to be in the movie. Whether or not that was a good idea, and obviously you need a young cast in here to make the Hollywood execs get hard. So you get Keanu, Carrie Elwes is in here. I'm sure for logical reasons that I can't quite work out. I don't think he's particularly great. I think Winona Ryder's okay at what she does. I think Keanu Reeves, let's be honest, not the best casting choice in Hollywood history. He's just a bit, believe it or not, a bit wooden, which is interesting. And his accent is fucking honking. His English accent is terrible. They should just made Jonathan Harker an American, and that would have made this work. But you can take that on the chin to be surrounded by the likes of Tom Waits, who is my Renfield. Like, to me, there will never be a Renfield like Tom Waits. My biggest complaint about Bram Stoker's Dracula is there isn't enough Renfield in it. I think Tom Waits is fucking amazing. The design of him, the more bat-like he gets towards the end, but the weird kind of brace thing he's got in his hands, those weird small round glasses that are all over the design here, and we're going to talk about that in a second. But he's fucking great. Richard E. Grant, great. I love me some Richard E. Grant. I think he's an incredible British actor, and he's absolutely awesome here. But then you have, it's like, let's count the Oscars. Anthony Hopkins as Van Helsing, also as the narrator, also at the as the priest at the beginning of the movie, who, you know, is blasphemed in front of and, you know, observes a curse that will befall Dracula. And then Gary Oldman, who... he's so fucking good in this movie. I mean, so fucking good. In fact, he makes this role look effortless, and he's incredible. He's menacing, he's playful, he's disturbing, he's articulate, he's haunting, he's tragic, he's heartbroken, and it's just a fucking, it's a clinic. He puts on an absolute clinic in this movie. And then add to that, the creature design. Well, he has like about four or five different creature designs in this movie and prosthetic makeups between old Dracula, who we're introduced to near the beginning of the movie when Harker arrives at the estate, him as a kind of half wolf man, him as a kind of half Batman, him as a decaying kind of vampire corpse man, and then other various assortment transformations. It's all fucking awesome. And he embodies those particular outfits with a grace and a style that is becoming a fucking incredible actor. He's mesmeric, I think. I don't think that is the word, but we'll use it. So he is. He's absolutely incredible in this movie. The design... though, this is, let's talk about some of the gothic design here and why you picked it. The design's absolutely nuts, and it's a combination of miniatures and like very, very clever superimposition and all these old tricks. Like we mentioned Bava earlier on, Bava utilized these tricks all the way through his movie, and the reason he did that, well, in his movies, was to get around the fact that, you know, maybe didn't have the budget or the technique. It was just easier to do it that way. Coppola, like, has a clear vision of how he wants the movie to look, and a lot of it at times is It's all practical. That's the thing about this movie. There's very little, if any, digital effects in this movie. It's using old-fashioned, classic techniques for kind of camera manipulation to get the desired effect. And as a result of that, this movie does not age a second because of that. It is fucking awesome. The only kind of digital effects you get here are the blue fire rings. And even then, they look fine. Like, no, they're not horrific in any way. Yes, we could probably have them better now with computers, but I don't mind it. So you have all those elements here. And the love story is kind of fucking incredible. Like, you really do feel Dracula's passion for Mina, and to, you know, recapture his lost love from four centuries before. The only tragic element about here is Winona Ryder's fine in the role, but, like, Gary Oldman is given, like 150% to the scenes, and a Winona Ryder 150% is maybe 25% of what Gary Oldman's given. And it doesn't sell every little aspect of it, but enough. You know, I can't take my eyes off this movie at all when I watch it. I think it's absolutely fucking incredible every step of the way in the best possible way. So you've got those elements as well, and I feel for them. Like, there are so many amazing scenes in this movie, from the point that they first meet to the time that they're actually in the, I mean, I don't know what we'd call it, like entertainment area where people are watching porn of the era on a screen. But the use of shadow puppetry as well in this movie is absolutely fucking nuts. This movie, unlike Crimson Peak, like, did fine at the, you know, at the cinema. Maybe not necessarily critically. I think the jury's still out, even to this day, on you either kind of really like this movie or you can't get over some of its hang-ups. But the movie, like, cost like $40 million, made $215 million, nominated for 4 Academy Awards, won 3. I don't necessarily think it won the best 3 overall, but I can't argue with sound editing, which is great, makeup, which is fucking incredible, and costume design. And let's take a bit of time to talk about the costume design in this one here. The costume designer was a Japanese gentleman, and this Japanese gentleman was not familiar with any of the adaptations of the source material, and as a result of that, you get this wonderful combination of Asian style kimonos and outfits. The warrior suit of Dracula's armor. There's something very dragon and very, it's weird to describe. It looks Asian as well in origin. But then all his style in London and the style of people in London is like this kind of almost, like, it's almost steampunk without it necessarily being steampunk. It's fucking incredible as well. So you have all that to boot. Michael Belhus, who does the cinematography here, like, is the MVP of the cinematography here, like, of all cinematographers. Like, this guy's body of work, once again, absolutely incredible. I mean, this is a guy that worked with Scorsese on Goodfellas, so you've got that to begin with. Or The Color of Money. You know, obviously did this movie with Coppola. Would go on and do an insane amount of movies afterwards, up into 2013 when he finished. You know, I think one of his final movies, it wasn't his final, but one of his final movies was The Departed. Once again, a kind of long-standing partnership with Scorsese. And if you have, you know, if Scorsese keeps coming back to you, well, ladies and gents, you ain't doing a lot wrong there. And then the final thing that kind of really sells this movie is its score. Wojciech Kilar, I think is how you pronounce it, Polish composer. The score for this one is fucking huge, and it's powerful, and it's romantic, and it's gothic, and it's dramatic, and it commands your attention. And the only thing better than this score is the Annie Lennox song, Love Song for a Vampire, which closes it out. I was obsessed with this song when it came out, which is a surprise no one that knows me. Like, I remember having the cassette. And it was I want to say it was a B-side as well. I can't remember if it was on the A-side or the B-side. But a big fan of the Eurythmics, big fan, still to this day, huge fan of Annie Lennox. And that's not because she's Scottish. although it does help. I think it's a beautiful song. It's an absolute, it's like beautiful, macabre, romantic poetry. And, you know, it kind of, it makes the movie, makes the end of the movie, really, if you were walking away from this movie still under any doubts that this is a movie that's predicated on love and romance, the closing credit song by Annie Lennox is the full stop exclamation mark to that as well. It's a beautifully gothic, deliciously macabre, rich textured world to live in. And I think it's like, we always kind of joked on directors to doing those directors conversations, and you could make an argument for Ford Coppola as very much like a Friedkin-esque character. That episode dropped recently, by the way, you should check it out, where we're talking about making some of the best movies Hollywood's ever seen and some of the worst. And Coppola's the same in a lot of respects, but Bram Stoker's one of those movies that just, to me anyway, exemplifies a kind of some flawed decisions and a movie which almost on some level bypasses, outgrows, overshadows those mistakes. Any issue you have with the casting in this movie is completely overshadowed by how lush, incredible, and vivid the movie is overall. I mean, as adaptations of source materials for Dracula go, it might be my favourite. It's one of my favourite vampire movies, my top five for sure, easily in my top five. And like Gary Oldman, I watched this movie again tonight. It's the first time I've watched it since the summer series 2 years ago for the 90s, 3 years ago. Time is a flat circle, ladies and gents. Where myself, in fact, I think almost all the hosts on that episode just gushed over it, and we put it through in the top two and it was removed. And we'll see if we can rectify that on next year's summer series when we revisit and add an additional spot in for 1992. I wholly expect Bram Stoker's Dracula to make it through there, and I want it at the big table. I want it in conversation, and I know some people have their issues with it. I just think the movie is bigger than the sum of its flaws. I think actually, if anything, makes the movie more charming and at times more entertaining with those flaws in them. I think this movie is, once again, it's like, I would maybe not use the words modern masterpiece because of its flaws, but I'll say it's top tier for the decade, for sure. It's another 5-star movie, ladies and gents. I think you nailed it. I think you 2 fives. It's not often that you get that on a double billing show, but you did it, and I'm immensely happy for it. Feel good. It's not, I just feel great when I get to talk about things I love, which you would think I would do more often because it's a show that I run. Them's the breaks. Right, so we're going to take our final break. When we come back, we're closing out the show and we're doing it right after this.
You're listening to the podcast Under the Stairs.
And you've been listening to the podcast Under the Stairs. This has been episode 329, another Listener Choice December episode, the Dream Double Bill, where you selected modern gothic masterpieces and you picked Bram Stoker's Dracula from 92 and Crimson Peak from 2015. I loved them. You knew I loved them. I guess that's why you picked them. If not, and you thought I'd hate them, then more the fool you, ladies and gents. More the fool you. We have 2 more Listener Choice episodes to drop before the podcast Under the Stairs officially closes its doors on the 24th of December. Yes, I'm doing Dexter shows in between, but that's our dirty little secret. Shh, okay? Don't tell us all. But yeah, we have two more. Both of them are coming next week. One of them is Dream Double True Crime Documentary. And yeah, you picked like, oh man, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get through the group. Dear Zachary broke my heart again when I watched it, and I'm going to have to talk about it. I've got a guest on for that one. Darren Wilson is going to share my misery. But we also get to talk about the phenomenal documentary, Tales of the Grim Sleeper, which is fucking great. So yeah, that's coming next week. And then on the 24th of December, Christmas Eve, you're getting the annual Teapots Christmas Eve commentary, where we're doing Dead Alive, aka Brain Dead. That'll be fun, because the Baz will be there and he's never seen them. He's never heard I Kick Arse for the Lord, and that is criminal. And we will solve that, rectify it for your listening pleasure, ladies and gents. There's a multitude of ways to check out podcasts on the stairs. Wherever you're listening, it's right now, hit subscribe. That way you get the shows as and when they drop, and access to the entire back catalogue of Teapots content. Don't stop there. We have a sister feed, which is the Teapots Collective. Over on the Teapots Collective, we get down and dirty on four different shows. One is Where to Begin With. The other one is Opera Omnia. Why not check out Doing the Nasty? And if you are so inclined, Chronicle is a show worth your time as well. All those shows are under the Teapots Collective banner. Subscribing to both those feeds is the best way to support what I do under the stairs. If you don't like using podcatchers, you can use our website, teapotscast.com. Links to all the shows are there, as well as a link to Jaws' Shite, another regrettable outbursty Booze Bees Banter Entertainment podcast featuring myself, The Baz, and Scott and Liam from Scott and Liam vs. Evil, where we get drunk, we talk about terrible life choices, we read your listener emails on air, and do weird news stories from around the globe. Jaws' Shite and Other Regrettable Outbursts exclusively available on teapotscast.com. If you want to check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/groups/teapotscast will take you to the podcast under the stairs. The Teapots Collective is just a Facebook page, so it's just simply facebook.com/teapotscast. If you want to get down and dirty with Jaws' Shite, it's facebook.com/groups/regrettablepod. If Facebook ain't your thang and you want to check us out on Instagram and Twitter, the twin prongs of social media sexiness, you can interact with myself and Baz over there at TeapotsCast for both. The podcast Under the Stairs returns for you tomorrow with the next installment, the penultimate installment of a Russian Roulette franchise retro on the Children of the Corn franchise. Parts 4 through 6 coming your way then. So until then, whatever you are, whatever the time zone is, and whatever you're up to in this big bad world of ours, please take care of yourselves out there. This is Duncan McLeish broadcasting live from under the stairs, and I am signing off. Coming to